our headlines.
Lebanon's Hezbollah movement says the second fuel shipment heading to Lebanon from Iran has arrived in Syria's Banias port. The Spanish government says former Catalan leader Carles Puigdemont, who's been arrested in Italy, must face justice in Spain. And the UK government urges public calm as shortage of lorry drivers forces the closure of some petrol stations in the country. Thank you for joining us. Beginning with our top story, Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah says a second ship loaded with diesel coming from Iran has arrived in Syria. Hezbollah says the vessel arrived in Banias port, northwest of Syria, on Thursday. The shipment will be divided into smaller batches and will be transported to Lebanon by tankers. The first vessel carrying Iranian fuel to Lebanon arrived in Syria on September the 12th. More shipments are expected in the coming days. Iran is sending fuel to Lebanon to help it ease its crippling energy shortages triggered by a deep financial meltdown. Hezbollah has blamed the crisis on U.S. sanctions targeting Lebanon. Our Beirut correspondent Mariam Saleh says Hezbollah donates all the fuel sent from Iran to crisis-hit institutions.
We saw it, of course, entering Lebanon and being distributed across the country. And they even said that this will be only for one community, for the supporters of Hezbollah. And we saw that this did not happen either. We saw that Hezbollah is sending, donating this fuel to the organizations, the humanitarian organizations, especially in the governmental hospitals that are in all areas, whether they are in areas which are generally supporters of political foes, or even areas where they are allies from all sects, from all religions. And we saw this happening, of course, very clearly. Hezbollah trying to make a national move. We heard from head of the parliamentary bloc, Mr. Mohammad Raad, in his last statement at the parliament, stressing that Hezbollah's move is a 100% pure national move. This is only for national security. We are not doing this for any sort of either political gains or profit.
Iran's Supreme Court Chief Ahmad Mortazavi Mokaddam has slammed U.S. sanctions on his country. The senior cleric described the embargoes as illegal and said they violate international law. He said the U.S. sanctions have hampered the Iranian people's access to medicine and vaccines. Mortazavi Mokaddam was speaking at a meeting of the Supreme Court chiefs of the member states of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. He also spoke about the latest developments in Afghanistan. The Iranian official said foreign interference in Afghanistan has denied people their legitimate rights for years now. He called on the international community to help the Afghan people. Muslim pilgrims are marching toward Iraq's holy city of Karbala to mark Arba'in. The pilgrims are arriving in the city to observe the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. This year, Arba'in falls on September the 28th. Prior to the pandemic, the event drew millions each year, but now the Iraqi government has restricted the number of foreign pilgrims. It has allowed only 40,000 foreign visitors into the country, many of them Iranians. Imam Hussein and dozens of his companions were martyred during the Battle of Karbala with the tyrant of their time over 13 centuries ago. They were killed on the day of Ashura. Spanish government says former Catalan leader Carles Puigdemont must face justice in Spain. Madrid's reaction follows Puigdemont's arrest in Italy on Thursday. His lawyer has said Puigdemont will appear in court later on Friday. Judges will decide on whether to let him go or extradite him to Spain. Puigdemont's supporters have gathered outside the Italian embassy in the Catalan capital, Barcelona, to protest his arrest. Puigdemont is wanted by the Spanish government over a 2017 independence referendum in Catalonia. At the time, Madrid ruled the vote unconstitutional and accused Puigdemont of sedition over the independence push. He fled to Belgium following the referendum. The British government has urged public calm as a shortage of truckers has caused problems in delivering fuel. British media say the shortage of drivers has already forced the closure of some gas stations. They say some other service stations are out of at least one type of fuel. There are also fears over a food supply crunch. The government insists there is no fuel shortage. It says it will do whatever it can to recruit more drivers. But the haulage industry says there are no quick fixes. It says it currently needs around 100,000 drivers to alleviate the shortage. The problem has been blamed on Brexit that has reduced the number of drivers working in the UK. The pandemic has contributed too, as it hampered the qualification process for new workers. British energy consumers are facing worrying price rises as the government admits it has to, quote, prepare for the worst as more energy firms buckle under the weight of global wholesale costs. Amina Taylor has more.
Millions of energy customers face spiraling price hikes as several smaller firms in the market have collapsed in a matter of days. Avro Energy and Green ceased trading on Wednesday, with existing customers now face being put onto expensive new tariffs, with the energy regulator warning there could be more bad news ahead.
It's not unusual for suppliers to go out of the market. I think what's different this time is that dramatic change in the costs that those suppliers are facing. So we've had around sort of, you know, we've had five roughly over the past few months. We've had a number more at the start of the year.
Business Minister Kwasi Kwarteng has already said there will be no bailout for the majority of energy firms, but the government will instead focus on the plight of the customer.
The government has been clear that protecting consumers is our primary focus and shapes our entire approach to this issue. We will protect, continue to protect, consumers with the energy price cap.
On the streets of the British capital, there were fears of what a price hike would mean, but also calls for accountability.
It's unacceptable. Everything is going high, even the price of food and everything is going high. Even the public transport, everything is going high. So the government, they should do something about that.
Are you worried that your bills might increase this winter?
Yes, I am. I'm a pensioner. I'm very worried about it.
At some point, there has to be a reason as to why this has happened, whether it could have been foreseen, whether things could have been done to prevent it. The people who run the energy companies, how much money have they made? How much money have they taken off and shipped offshore? That should be looked at.
The British consumer has had a tough couple of months. First of all, dealing with the uncertainty around Brexit, the fallout from the COVID crisis, and now the prospect of spiraling energy costs.
Once more, it will be the most vulnerable who may yet again bear the brunt of any drastic price hikes this winter, with some households having to choose between heating and eating. Amina Taylor, London.
Welcome to the News Review segment. North Korea has dismissed as premature South Korea's offer of declaring a formal end to the decades-long war between the two sides.
Nothing will change as long as the political circumstances around the DPRK remain unchanged and the U.S. hostile policy is not shifted, even if the termination of the war is declared hundreds of times.
The North Korean Vice Foreign Minister added that an end-of-war declaration would have no legal binding force considering the tensions in the Korean Peninsula. He noted that ending Washington's hostile policy against Pyongyang will be the most important step in bringing peace and stability to the region. In a speech at the United Nations General Assembly earlier this week, South Korean President Moon Jae-in proposed that the two Koreas, the United States and possibly China, declare the formal end to the 1950 war, which is still technically being fought since a ceasefire was declared in 1953. Now, joining me out of Hong Kong to discuss this story further are Andrew K.P. Leung. He is an international and independent China strategist, and also Fabrizio Goldoni. He is an independent journalist and analyst. Andrew, if I can start off with you, North Korea says South Korea's call to declare a formal end of war is premature, seeing that there is no guarantee that it would lead to the withdrawal of U.S. hostile policy toward Pyongyang. What is your reaction to this?
Well, the objective of ending this war situation has been around for a long, long time. Don't forget the six-party talks, which lasted for years. And then, of course, they're under the Trump administration, supposedly offering and holding out an olive branch, even Trump crossing the border to shake hands with Kim. But at the end, the Americans always believed that they could start off with a position of dominance, of using military coercion. And then after all these talks, there was no sign that the Americans were able to scale down the kind of military dominance and the threat of regime change for North Korea. So that's why Kim has been learning the tricks for a long, long time and is want to ensure this the nuclear development as a kind of insurance policy. So unless the Americans are changing their stance, giving up the kind of coercive kind of approach or military approach and going back to a genuine step-by-step of building trust on both sides, I don't think that the North Koreans and Kim would really go along with any other kind of peace talks or going around the table and giving up its nuclear power, nuclear and missile development, which is, of course, this kind of survival insurance policy for the North Koreans.
All right. Mr. Goldoni, what's your reaction to what Andrew said, and also what do you think should be done in order to stabilize the situation at the Korean Peninsula?
But, basically, I do agree with the guest, as just been told. In my opinion, the approach should be a step-by-step approach. You know, I don't see an approach like the 2018 between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un, where basically Trump was asking, you drop the nuclear program, you drop the ballistic missile program, and then we will remove the sanction, okay? It's not so simple, the things. The things is much, much more complicated. And also in terms of actors, there are multiple actors in this theater. We have the South Korea, the South Korea is militarized, basically, through two American bases that they have 30,000 unit people. And also we have to remember that the 7th Fleet, the 7th U.S. Navy Fleet, basically is just around Japan, where they have another 55,000 units. So North Korea is something that belongs to a very complicated issue. It's not only a matter of nuclear capability or ballistic missiles. It's a small country, surrounded by giant forces, and most probably you need to have some deterrent, you know, to survive.
Okay, I appreciate your time. I've been talking to Andrew K.P. Leung. He is an international and independent China strategist, joining us out of Hong Kong, and also Fabrizio Goldoni. He is an independent journalist and analyst, also joining us out of Hong Kong. Welcome back. Former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin has appealed his conviction for the murder of African-American George Floyd in May 2020. Chauvin appealed the conviction with a Minnesota district court on the last day he was able to do so. He has accused the state of prejudicial misconduct. Chauvin has also accused the court of abusing its discretion by denying requests to postpone or move the trial. In June this year, the former police officer was sentenced to more than 22 years in prison for killing Floyd. who killed a black man in Minneapolis by kneeling on his neck for nearly 10 minutes despite the victim's plea for help. Floyd's death sparked an outcry both inside and outside the U.S. against racial injustice and police brutality. The United States has banned the use of horses by its border guards at Del Rio, Texas, following widespread criticism over the mistreatment of migrants.
We feel those images are horrible and horrific. There is an investigation the president certainly supports, overseen by the Department of Homeland Security, which he has conveyed will happen quickly. I can also convey to you that the secretary also conveyed to civil rights leaders earlier this morning that we would no longer be using horses in Del Rio. So that is something, a policy change that has been made in response.
The White House faces condemnations at home and abroad after images went viral on social media showing Border Patrol agents on horseback whipping the refugees. Meanwhile, the U.S. Special Ambassador to Haiti has resigned over the deportation of thousands of migrants from the U.S.-Mexico border. Daniel Foote slammed the U.S. policy toward Haiti and called the expulsions inhumane. The U.S. is grappling with a surging influx of asylum seekers, mostly Haitians, who have fled years of grinding poverty worsened by a recent devastating quake and a storm. An Iranian teenager who risked his life to rescue two women from fire earlier this month has passed away due to severe burns. The incident happened in the southern city of Izeh 2 weeks ago. Ali Landi, 15 years old, jumped into the fire after seeing a neighboring house ablaze with four women trapped inside. He had managed to get two of them out to safety before rescuers arrived at the scene. However, he sustained third-degree burns. Landy was taken to hospital, but on Friday he succumbed to his severe burns covering 90% of his body. Landy has been called a national hero in Iran. Well, that does it for this edition of World News.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
September the 22nd marks the anniversary of the Iraq-Iran War of 1980, when Iran found itself isolated against the aggressor Saddam Hussein, who had a world behind him. But the day is matched by the National Day of Defense Industry, marked on August the 22nd this year. That's a healthy antidote to a bitter memory the country is determined not to see anytime soon. With over 40 years of sanctions, including 8 years of war, Iran understood the importance of military independence. But how deterring is our military program, and is it economically justified? For answers, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today.
Thank you.
military self-sufficiency for survival is a mantra set deep in the Iranian psyche. How Iran has gone about attaining self-sufficiency is by indigenizing defense technologies and benefiting from talented youth's manpower in the armed forces. Much attention has been paid to creating and expanding a missile arsenal. Mr. Kortari is an MP and retired IRGC commander. He shared his experiences with us in Parliament, where we went to meet him. Why has this country focused so much on missiles?
If we didn't have it, they would have certainly destroyed us. You need to act with power against bullies and aggressors. There's no room for a negotiation with someone who doesn't understand the language of logic. Look at Afghanistan. They admitted to killing children under the pretext of targeting Daesh and Al-Qaeda terrorists. They don't understand anything. They believe everything has to be in their interests. But that couldn't be any further from the truth. God has created everyone equal.
Mr. Khoshchesh is a senior political analyst and familiar face on Press TV. He joined us on Skype this time.
Threats, military threats against Iran are now part of the U.S. Strategy, permanent strategy, in order to subdue Tehran. Therefore, they have left Tehran with no other choice but to reinvigorate itself, especially considering that Iran has been under toughening sanctions, and many war powers have defied helping Iran with military tools and equipment, therefore forcing Tehran to develop its arms program, which actually started during the eight-year-long war imposed by former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, when Iran was not even provided by, the most simple weapons and tools. When Iran intended to import barbed wires, they never allowed Iran, and they confiscated two trucks, alongside borders of CIS countries in the north of Iran, and Iran was under tough sanctions during the eight-year-long war.
The missile program is the cornerstone of Iranian defense strategy and deterrence. It emerged after Iran acquired the art of reverse engineering missiles it had acquired from different sources. Effective deterrence capability should be economic justification enough for the missile program.
During Operation Khaybar in 1984 in the Talaye area, the 27th Division was commanded by Haj Ibrahim Hemmat, who was martyred during the same operation. He was a teacher before the Islamic Revolution and used to run away from Savak. He was under considerable pressure there, as there were many injured and martyrs, and the Iraqis were repelling their attacks. It got to a point where Hassan Tehrani Mogaddam, known as the father of Iran's missile program, who was a student at the time, got to the front line. He used to monitor the news and knew that we were under tremendous pressure there. I was helping Haj Ahmad, who was the commander. Tehrani Mogaddam promised to bring in a missile and target the Iraqis' fortifications so we could advance. The next morning, he brought a Toyota with a metal beam welded on the back and a missile on top. He fired a missile, which flew about 4 meters and landed in front of the Toyota. We were shocked by what happened and asked him what went wrong. He said, "I make missiles." That was in 1984. He resolutely continued his work and made better missiles later.
Thanks to the U.S. drones, sophisticated drones like RQ Sentinel 160s, 170, Scan Eagle, MQ-4, MQ-9, or Reaper, all other types, different types of U.S. Sophisticated drones that Iran has hunted and brought down and reverse engineered and reproduced all of them, Iran is now able to, it has actually manufactured different kinds of drones, very advanced drones that are radar evading. Iran has developed the needed geometrical shape, the coating, the structure and the texture of the body and the wings that are needed. These are different systems used for radar evading aircraft and drone. And Iran has developed this technology through reverse engineering the captured U.S. drones. Iran is now equipped with the most sophisticated drone technology, and the CENTCOM commander of the United States said just a few weeks ago that they have lost superiority in the Middle East because of the U.S. drone, because of Iranian drones in the region.
Sanctions against armed forces in Iran and the defense industry are not new. The Air Force, a conventional force, has also been subject to harsh sanctions for many years. Where negotiations for sanctions lifting might fail, Iran turns to neutralizing sanctions by boosting its industry. It's not just arms and missiles. Communications networking is itself a power factor in modern wars. And the Ministry of Defense boasted in August that it had managed to localize communications networks in the country. Presently, we have established fair cooperation and collaboration with 600 academic centers and 900 knowledge-based companies in line with meeting demands of the armed forces in relevant fields. This, the chief executive of Electronic Industries Organization of the Ministry of Defense said. That's Brigadier General Shahrukh Shahram. Iran's military history is as old as global civilization itself. This country is known to have created the world's first empire 2,500 years ago, a benevolent empire. And so, it's perfectly aware of the importance of arms. But given Iran's position in the world of today and the fact that it's ruled by religious doctrine, makes it care more for defense, rather defense and deterrence. Chief of Staff of Iran's Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Bagheri, said that the policy of the armed forces is to increase the ability to attack the centers of threats. His statement released on the occasion of the anniversary of National Day of Defense Industry read, "Increasing the ability to attack the centers of threat against the Islamic country is a strategic, unstoppable policy of the armed forces." As a soldier during the war, to what extent did you feel the lack of equipment?
It was so severe, both in terms of weapons and ammunition. We would take most of them from Iraqis themselves because they were backed by dollars coming from Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Qatar, and Kuwait. Our personnel would cover their shortages from them. Syria was the only country that sold us weapons until the very end of the war. Although Libya worked with us in the first 3-4 years, and North Korea sold us weapons in the last 3-4 years.
The Islamic Republic believes it has aimed straight for military self-sufficiency, looking at its achievements in strengthening foundations of the resistance front, as well as expanding its defense capability beyond Iranian borders. Its armed forces and defense sector can be taken as a centerpiece of security and stability in the region. Iranian commanders believe the country's military self-sufficiency has reached such a level that the courage to attack Iran doesn't exist. The accuracy of Iranian missiles in attacking, say, ISIS can serve as proof. The IRGC, or Revolution Guard Corps, launched the permanent aerospace fair showcasing ballistic missiles in September 2020. I will go on to 2021 as well. There it unveiled its third-generation naval strike ballistic missile. It showcased the Zulfaqar-e-Basir missile with a range of more than 700 kilometers as its new-generation ballistic missile. The newest projectile is fitted with a warhead that is guided by an optical seeker head. The country has deployed Zulfaqar-e-Basir against overseas targets, such as gatherings of the terror group Daesh, as well as the United States' Ain al-Assad Air Base in Iraq. That was targeted after the U.S. assassination of Qasem Soleimani, Iran's top anti-terror general. Other capabilities demonstrated in the exhibition were UAVs, satellites, defense systems, reconnaissance apparatus, and electronic warfare, as well as some of the invading drones that were shot down by the Corps in the past, including American and Israeli ones. More on military equipment and missiles after a quick diversion into world media. To have a look at what other outlets have to say, I invite you indoors. And here's how they word it. We've got Tasnim news and an expression of determination. Iran's new defense minister vows to build up IRGC's military power. The new defense minister of Iran pledged that his ministry will do its utmost to boost the capabilities of the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps. In a meeting with the IRGC commander, Major General Hossein Salami in Tehran, Defense Minister Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashtiani
reaffirmed the Defense Ministry's full support for all armed forces of the country. Highlighting the need for a revolutionary approach in the military sector coupled with the continuation of the previous efforts, the General said the Defense Ministry will employ all of its capacities to deepen and boost the defense capabilities and fulfill the needs of the armed forces, specifically the IRGC, including by supplying modern and strategic systems and equipment. Brigadier General Ashtiani stressed that coordination, synergy, and convergence among Iranian military units will ensure the fulfillment of the strategic needs of the armed forces and strengthening of the defense power. Tehran Times tells of an unprecedented show of military capability. Iran sets foot in backyard of the U.S. Now, with a serious test of Iran's naval capability for a long-term mission in distant waters, Iran has set its feet in the backyard of the Americans in the North Atlantic Ocean or any other body of water in the world. The 75th Naval Fleet of the Army, consisting of Makran Big Ship and Sahan Destroyer, finally entered the territorial waters of Iran in the past few days after 133 days of navigation and 44,000 kilometers of sea route in the most unprecedented mission in the history of Navy of Iran's Army and docked in Bandar Abbas. What sets this mission distinct from its previous 74 missions is not only the long without docking journey along the route, but also Iran's first presence in the North Atlantic, which has always been considered the backyard of the United States, Britain, and France. That would be it for the news section, but do stay tuned. More of the program coming up.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
Iran's ballistic missile systems, supplemented by cruise missiles and UAVs, are intended for deterrence but can be used for battle. This is complemented by asymmetric warfare tactics. Israel may have over 200 nuclear warheads, but their troops on the ground wouldn't have much to say for themselves. Look at its recent war with Lebanon. Anyhow, not yet fully provoked, Iran has kept its ballistic missiles down at a range limit of 2,000 kilometers. Its priority is to improve precision rather than increase range, notable in several missile systems. Say, the Qiyam-1 is an 800-kilometer range variant of the Shahab-2 short-range ballistic missile with a 500-kilogram separable warhead and ground-based guidance augmentation. A modified version of the Qiyam, which appears to have a maneuverable re-entry vehicle to further improve its accuracy, was used in the January 2020 attack against Ain al-Assad Air Base in Iraq. The MRD is based on the longer-range Qadr-1 variant of the Shahab-3 medium-range ballistic missile and has claimed a range of 1,800 kilometers. It is also equipped with a separating MARV. The Rode Mobile solid-fuel short-range ballistic missiles of the Fateh family have evolved both in range and in accuracy. They have evolved in range from about 300 kilometers to a claimed 1,400 kilometers and in accuracy by means of the incorporation of terminal guidance, including an anti-ship version.
The system, third of Khordad, is so popular now among the world armies that they have requested Iran to, supply them with this kind of air defense shield. And also the missile Sayyad that was used to bring down that aircraft is now requested by some countries. Some of these systems have been, taken to Syria and deployed in there in order to be integrated into the Syrian air defense shield now. So Iran has spread and developed its air defense points from a few to 3,000 now. And in the near future, Iran plans to increase it to 5,000 to 6,000 points. So there is no place left, in Iran that could be targeted by anyone, by any kind of aircraft. The Iranian radars and air defense shields can identify targets from a range of 3,000 kilometers away as soon as they, start flying.
The Fateh family also shows the important strides Iran has taken in solid propellant missiles. Their advantage is because of their launch preparation time, which is much shorter. Iran's long-term missile development priorities will focus on missiles powered by solid propellants. Those overcome the operational and performance limitations of the country's liquid propellant systems. The emphasis on precision, together with the move towards solid propellants, is combined clearly in the Fateh family of short-range ballistic missiles. The country is having rolled out three new Fateh variants, Zulfaqar, Dezful, and Haj Qasem, over only 4 years is a remarkable development. If prevention is better than cure, deterrence comes before defense. And Iran is continuing to develop and introduce armed UAVs and cruise missiles. UAVs being unmanned aerial vehicles.
Iran has built warships, destroyers, it's working on submarines. The Navy commanders say if the country feels the need for long-distance deployment, then they are very much able to even produce aircraft carriers.
Major General Hossein Salami of the IRGC said, "We can hit moving targets in the ocean from the heart of our land. That would mean targeting aggressive aircraft carriers and warships by long-range ballistic missiles. It is usual to hit moving targets in the sea by low-speed cruise missiles. But using long-range missiles is a great defense breakthrough for us because we can hit moving targets in the ocean from the heart of our land," he said. Military self-sufficiency is warranted by having your own military equipment, but you've also got to have your own people to strategize and put the equipment to use. Missiles aside, another crucial dimension of Iran's defenses is its asymmetric war doctrine that aims to avoid direct confrontation with the enemy by using surprise and deception and creating a complex battlefield to make sustainable operations difficult for the adversary. This asymmetric or mosaic defense doctrine in Iran was evolved by 2005, after the 2003 invasion of Iraq, when Iran saw the U.S. practically on its own doorstep. Since 2012, Iran has been adding an offensive dimension by adopting hybrid warfare. Known as the forward defense doctrine, it recommends fighting opponents off outside Iran's borders before they get too close.
What the United States is Iran's arch foe. Israel is another arch foe. And they are armed to the teeth. When Iran started its arms development program, it was under sanctions. Nobody helped Iran. Iran was not able to produce even mortars or bullets or individual arms, sophisticated arms for soldiers decades ago. While the Americans had they enjoyed the most sophisticated arms that any power or any country could have. So Iran was thinking of how it can defuse the threats of Israel and the United States in the shortest time possible. And then they went after asymmetrical warfare. And they developed asymmetrical warfare techniques, tactics, and gradually it became a doctrine.
Pre-revolution in the 1970s, Iran was undergoing a massive modernization program under the Shah.
Its armed forces were being equipped with mostly American and British manufactured equipment. But with the revolution, orders or deliveries were cancelled by Western suppliers.
قبل از انقلاب خب اینطور بود که هر چقدر
It appeared that before the Islamic Revolution, the US and Europe would provide Iran with whatever weapons and arms we wanted. But the reality was that the Iranian military personnel couldn't use the equipment and weapons that much. We saw they couldn't do anything against the Iranian people. They didn't have much capability to fight the enemies either. As we have seen throughout history, including under Reza Pahlavi's rule during World War II, the British invaded Iran from the south, the Russians from the north. And Iran's military didn't put up much resistance.
Iran did not have to rebuild its defense capabilities entirely from scratch, but it required strategic redirection. That would be to apply the revolutionary ideals of independence and self-reliance to defense. The problems of military dependence can be demonstrated by referring to the recent events in Afghanistan. When American maintenance services to the Afghan army were cut off, it could no longer use the world's most advanced fighters and helicopters. Many of these weapons are unused in Afghanistan today. Also, fighter jets delivered to Arab countries are in the same situation and cannot be used without U.S. permission and guidance. The billions of dollars the U.S. and NATO spent on the Afghan military on training and equipping it could not fix major internal flaws. And on August the 15th, the Taliban simply captured the Afghan capital, Kabul, and announced the war in Afghanistan is over.
Finally, I want to say that the same situation persists in Afghanistan today. The Americans stationed their troops in Afghanistan, and according to their estimates, paid $2 trillion for establishing a so-called peace. However, the main objective wasn't to empower Afghanistan, but to establish a base for them in an area between China, Russia, India, and Iran to keep an eye on them.
In Iran, pre-1979, Mohammad Reza Shah the King paid up front for his whopping load of military equipment. But even that was denied Iran after the revolution. Not just that, here's what happened to thousands of tanks bought from Britain. Iran had paid for them in the 1970s, but they were sold on to Iraq. So during the war of the 1980s, Iran was turned on by its own tanks, basically. Also, Iran's Air Force had to learn how to keep its large fleet of US-built aircraft and helicopters operational single-handedly. And so this country began establishing its own aerospace industry.
Also, Iran has developed its own fourth-generation aircraft for combat and for surveillance as well as training. This has happened through a self-sufficiency plan and move. Also, Iran has made a conceptual model of fifth-generation aircraft. That's the most modern aircraft in the world. There are only 10 types of fifth-generation aircraft, and the Iranian one is the fifth one. Of course, it's the conceptual model, but the most important feature in this kind of aircraft is their radar-evading feature.
Former Iranian Defense Minister Brigadier General Hatami stated, "Today, we have gained various achievements in different fields, which are not limited to ground combat. And in the field of missiles, we are undoubtedly one of the world powers. And in the field of unmanned armed vehicles, we are even better than the world's top powers. The main focus of our activity is to gain access to strategic weapons in all areas. That would be all areas excluding dirty weapons." The founder of the revolution, Ayatollah Khomeini, frequently condemned WMDs and especially chemical weapons, the kind that killed thousands upon thousands of Iranians during the eight-year war with Iraq. That'll be all for today. Thanks from the whole team. Do tune in again at the same times next week and each week after, as you never know what's on. Bye for now.
السلام علیک
يا أبا عبد الله.
وإنما خرجت لطلب الإصلاح في أمة جدي صلى الله عليه وآله.
The words of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam in dialogue.
صلى الله عليك يا أبا عبد الله.
Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the grandson of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, the son of the commander of the faithful Imam Ali, the son of the Lady of Light, the esteemed Fatima bint Muhammad. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the beacon of light which guides towards beauty and perfection. The one who addresses Allah on the day of Ashura saying, in so many difficulties and sorrows, in which friends desert the person and enemies unleash their cruel tongues, I have unburdened myself upon you and brought my grievances upon you. And brought my grievances before you, O Allah. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the master of martyrs, these are his words. Imam al-Hussein's words at زبال.
قال الإمام الحسين عليه السلام بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم أما بعد وقد أتانا خبر فظيع قتل مسلم بن عقيل وهانئ بن عروة وعبد الله بن يقطر وقد خذلتنا شيعتنا فمن أحب منكم الانصراف فلينصرف ليس عليه منا ذمام.
In the name of Allah, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Now to our topic. Indeed, a distressing piece of news has reached us. Muslim ibn Aqil, Hani bin Urwa, and Abdullah bin Yaqtur have been murdered, and our followers have forsaken us. Hence, any of you who may wish to return can go back. There is no longer any commitment to us on you.
As-salamu alayka ya ترجمة متين قتلت حسين شفاعة جده يوم الحساب. السلام على الخد التريق.
And now let's listen to Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakhr al-Ruhani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, bin nasta'in. Assalamu alayki ya Abdullah. In this context, we find that Imam al-Husayn al-Salam assured his interlocutor that he was certain of the religious sincerity of his peers, his close relatives, and his family members. Please note carefully that Imam al-Husayn al-Salam never imposed it on anybody to join him in his movement. This was because such a great movement certainly needed volunteers. Imam al-Husayn al-Salam declared his movement and the aim of his movement so that those people who sensed the historic importance and significance of Imam al-Husayn's movement would join him. At the same time, we find that Imam al-Husayn al-Salam intended to have such kind of people in his company that would certainly be very much resolute in the decisions and to be constant with his own standards. Because of this, we find that Imam al-Husayn al-Salam indicated it several times that he tested all his companions and made sure that they were in his own way. We find that, politically speaking, in many historical movements, in many revolutions in the world, that in the beginning some people join a revolution, but after some time they avert from the that revolution's mainstream. However, in the case of Imam al-Husayn al-Salam, it wasn't the case. Not only none of those close relatives of Imam al-Husayn al-Salam who had joined him either from Medina or from Mecca, but also many of the enemy soldiers joined Imam al-Husayn al-Salam in Karbala. And this indicates that Imam al-Husayn al-Salam's movement was the right movement. And not only Imam al-Husayn al-Salam, but also his close relatives and his martyred companions were assured of the righteousness of his movement. From this we understand that such a kind of movement, I mean such a great historic and epoch-making movement, needs sincerity and resoluteness. All of these characteristics are observable in both Imam al-Husayn al-Salam and in the character and career of his martyred companions. Sallallahu alayka ya Aba Abdullah.
السلام عليك يا أبا عبد الله.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of the program Dialogue. We hope that you remain under the auspicious grace of Imam Husayn today and always.
you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.